welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get rolling. If you remember, I shared my thoughts about Take My Hand by Dolan Perkins Valdez in the spring preview episode in early April. It was only my second five-star book of 2022. It's a historical fiction novel based on true events, and it is absolutely heartbreaking. It will be one of my favorite books of 2022, no question. Dolan is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Winch and Bomb. She was a finalist for two NAACP Image Awards and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award for Fiction, and was awarded the first novelist award by the Black Caucus of the ALA. She's the current chair of the board of the Penn Faulkner Foundation and is associate professor in the literature department at American University. She lives in Washington, D.C. with her family. Welcome, Dolan.
Thank you.
For those who have not had a chance to read Take My Hand yet, can you tell us a little bit about it without spoiling anything?
Sure. Take My Hand is set in Montgomery, Alabama, 1973. And it is about a nurse who works at a federally funded planning clinic. She's a recent college graduate. This is her first job. And she's very excited to not only be a nurse in practice, but to also give back to her community. She is originally from the Centennial Hill section of Montgomery, Alabama. And she's the daughter of a doctor. And she really believes in the mission of the clinic, which is to help impoverished women have reproductive control over their lives. But it's not long after she goes to work at that clinic that she's assigned two young patients who are 11 and 13 years old, who have been put on birth control. And she has to wrestle with the decision that the clinic has made to put them on birth control. And while she's wrestling with that, something really tragic happens that changes their lives and that changes her life forever.
What about this particular story called you to write a book about it? Because it is based on real events.
I was really driven, Sarah, by outrage. I had a sense that I had found a story that needed to be told. So for me, the question wasn't, should I write this story? The question was, how could I not write this story? It's one of those stories that you think has already been written, but it hasn't. So I just felt an urgency to first get it down on paper and to secondly share it with my readers because I wanted them to know about it. I was concerned that there were forced sterilizations still happening in contemporary America in certain communities. And if we're not given the proper context of the history of those kinds of abuses, then we're not that equipped to deal with them when they happen now. So I just wanted people to know about it.
And that was something that struck me as well. The fact that I didn't know much of anything about this story going into it. And I was so surprised that we hadn't learned about this in school. And I know this occurred sort of around the same time as Tuskegee, maybe a little bit later. And I know you have a connection. You grew up near there. Why do you think Tuskegee got a lot of attention and this story really didn't?
Well, my dad went to Tuskegee and graduated in the late 1960s. So I had heard a lot about what happened to those men when I was growing up. I didn't really understand the scope of it until I was older. I was able to read about it for myself. But I knew that there had been this terrible government program in which nearly 600 men were enrolled in this study, 400 of whom had syphilis, who were left untreated for an entirely curable disease. The thing about Tuskegee is it goes on for 40 years, and it goes on sort of as an open secret. People knew about it. They were publishing about it in the medical journals. Forced sterilization also has a similar scope in the sense that there have been forced sterilizations in this country for decades. of different populations. But the Ralph story, which is the story that inspired mine, the story of the Ralph sisters, is just one family story in the middle of many. It's an extraordinary story, right? It is one that captivated the nation across national newspapers. Every major newspaper in the country had a story about those girls in 1973. But it is just one story. So I think a lot more people knew about forced sterilizations in general than they did about this particular story. And for me, this is the, like, if you're going to choose one story, this is that story because those girls were so young.
Yes. And why did you decide to write this as fiction versus nonfiction? And did you ever consider writing this as nonfiction?
I don't anymore. In my early days, I used to think, well, maybe this is an essay or maybe this is an article. I don't think like a nonfiction writer. I read something in the archives and immediately I have a sense of what parts of the story are silent. I have a sense of what's not there. And that's for me, the impetus to keep digging. I have these nagging questions usually that I can't answer. And so I try to answer them in these novels. Or rather, it's not so much that I try to answer them, but I try to share those questions with an audience so we can try to answer them together so that we can sort of tease this out. And that's what I'm doing. I'm taking something in the archive. I have questions about it. I'm putting it in novelistic form so that we can try to figure out what happened here.
And in this book, I know the perspective that you found lacking in real life was that of the nurses at the clinic. So you created the character of Civil, who is the nurse. Is there anywhere else that you kind of sort of took liberties for fiction in this case, or is that really the big one? And what about the nurse's perspective was intriguing and appealing to you that you wanted to sort of tease that out in this book?
I mean, you're absolutely right. The nurse is the biggest change because I didn't find any archival material from the nurses themselves in the nurses' own words. What I found was a bit in the local newspaper. Originally, the lawsuit that was filed was against the clinic. And the head nurse, who was a white woman, in defense of the actions of the clinic, insisted that it must have been okay because all eight nurses who worked at the clinic were Black. And that was the only reference I found to those nurses. And so you see in like the second chapter of my novel, she says there were eight of us. That really was something that I was curious about. So that I say, yes, that's a major shift from what actually happened to my book. I would say in terms of other changes that I made the girls slightly younger. In real life, the Ralph sisters were 12 and 14 years old. My girls are 11 and 13. Also, the lawsuit was fought in federal court in Washington, D.C., when I spoke with a lawyer who argued the case, Joseph Levin, I asked him, was it possible for you to have argued this case in the Middle District Federal Court in Alabama? And he said, yes, but I argued it in D.C. I said, but was it possible? Was it possible?
Sure.
And he said, yes, but the case went to Washington, D.C. And so that's the difference between me and a journalist coming to him, right? Like, I'm really thinking about the contours of the story. It was really important to me to keep this story local and to keep this story where the crime happened, basically, like close to the scene of the crime, so that that emotional fallout could also be simultaneous with all of the legal fallout that's also happening.
Sure. And I'm curious about this. In Take My Hand, Erica or India, I can't remember which one of them had not hit puberty yet when she was being given birth control. Was that the case in the actual case in real life?
Not that I know of. I never found that.
That was especially jarring.
Yes. I did make that change because, well, there was a part of me that felt like it didn't even matter. When I say it didn't matter, I mean, even if she had hit puberty, it was still an overstep to put those girls on particularly an experimental birth control, right? But as I drafted the novel, it just came to me one day that one of them has not hit puberty yet. And so I made that change just out of what my character spoke to me. Because, you know, once you put those characters on the page, they have a mind of their own and they begin to tell you who they are. And so that was something that came to me in a later draft that she had not hit puberty.
I would love to hear a little bit about your research process. You'd mentioned talking to the attorney, Joseph Levin. Tell me a little bit about other things you did, who else you talked to. I love kind of hearing the behind the scenes of this kind of stuff.
Well, you know, I'm finally, now that this is my third book, I'm finally figuring out that I even have a process.
You have a system now.
I do now. I never knew. I don't think I had a system in the early days. I probably started to develop a system with the second book, but now I'm actually aware of what my system is, my process. So now I can actually do my process for books, which is amazing, right? So my process starts with reading everything I can. So I'm checking books out of the library. I'm scouring the internet. I'm getting things from interlibrary loan. I'm looking to see where there are special collections with any kind of primary source materials that I can use. I'm reading newspaper articles. I'm reading books by historians. You know, I'm just learning as much as I can because I can't even begin to approach the page until I have a little bit of an idea of what I'm doing. The second thing I do is I start cold calling. And this is one thing that I just realized that I do. I didn't really realize I did it until recently, but I begin just calling people. If I have a question, I'll call a journalist, I'll call an attorney. I just call people.
Do you have set sort of sources in various fields that you go to over and over? Like I have a couple attorneys that I go to for legal questions.
Well, I have my friends.
Yeah.
Although my good friend who's a lawyer, when I was asking her some of the legal questions, she said, just watch Law and Order. That'll teach you everything you need to know. So that was her help. But I do have lots of lawyer friends. I live in Washington, D.C. There's lots of lawyers there. And also I live with one. But I would say I do a lot of cold calling because each project is different. So I don't have a set group of people who I go to. My set group would be just any friends that I have in my friend circle, or I have a couple of friends who read early drafts for me. That's really more useful to me, is to have some readers, some early readers. Yeah, but mostly I'm cold calling and people are very nice. Sometimes I have to, I don't have to say this, but I say it because sometimes it makes people feel easier about talking to me. I'll say I'm a professor at American and I'm doing research, and that sort of relaxes them. That gives me some institutional backing.
Absolutely. And you spoke to the social worker, Jesse Bly, is that right?
Oh, yes.
What were kind of some of the big things you learned from her? Because she wasn't really, I feel like there was a social worker tangentially in the book, but not as more of a central character.
That's right, because I knew that this family would have had a social worker in my book. And I had to address the absence of one, and I did. And in a way, Sybil sort of becomes like a social worker to them.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. But in real life, they did have nurses and they had a social worker, and Jesse Bly was their social worker. She was the one who took the case to Joe Levin after she went to the hospital and she discovered they had been sterilized. She was distraught. Her husband was in the military. She went to his commanding officer to ask for advice. Who do I report this to? What do I do? And my understanding is that his commanding officer referred her. He said, there's a young civil rights attorney in town by the name of Joe Levin. Call him.
Oh, okay.
And she went to his office and he wasn't there. And she sat in the waiting room all day long waiting for him. And when he came in, she told him what had happened and begged him to take the case. But she didn't have to beg him. He immediately took it. And she's extraordinary. And when I talked to Joe Levin, I didn't know anything about her. And he said, have you talked to Jesse Bly? And I said, who is Jesse Bly? And he said, oh, she was the girl's social worker. And I said, is she still alive? He said, yes. You know, she lives right here close by.
Oh, interesting.
And I cold called her, asked her if I could take her to dinner. And when I was leaving the SPLC, where I had been researching there, Joe Levin said to me, tell Jesse I said hi. Tell her I never forgot her and that I still think about her. And when I talked to her, she said the same thing. Please tell Joe I said hi.
Oh.
You know, so they, across these last 40 years, have maintained this connection.
Sure.
That they were involved in something extraordinary.
Yeah. I want to talk about one of the big themes in the book, and Sybil really had to kind of learn this throughout the story. And that's the destructive possibility of good intentions in the context of when you're helping people. I thought it was interesting, too, that in this case, you see the white savior figure in fiction sometimes. This was not the case here. This was more of a class disparity. And through your research and your personal experience, what have you learned and how do you feel about how to ride that line when helping people? Because that was a struggle that Sybil had throughout the course of the book.
Right. I'm still tangling with this myself, honestly. I don't have a good answer. And I guess this is one of those questions that I want the readers to decide for themselves. I do know that I see myself in Sybil. I see my own desire to do right by people, to be the daughter that my mother raised. You know, in the South, we have a saying, to whom much is given, much is required. And you grow up hearing that your whole life, that we're supposed to share our gifts, right? But in this book, I ask the question, what exactly is required of us? And how do we meet that expectation of sharing our gifts? Who stands to benefit? And do they want to benefit? And who are we to make the decision of how we're going to share those gifts? Sometimes we have to just wait until our gifts are called upon. You know, there's that aspect of benevolence too. You know, part of being benevolent is knowing when to extend and when to wait. So I don't have an easy answer to these questions, but I think they're questions that we should all consider. And I think there are a lot of good people out here trying to do good things who could stand to take a pause every now and then and reflect.
Sure. Yeah, I don't have a good answer either. But I felt for Sybil. I mean, that really stuck out to me in the book as one of the sort of huge takeaways from it. And no, I haven't figured out the answer still. And kind of taking this a step further as we sort of bring in government agencies into this, the theme of coercion of poor people by government agencies, that's a quote from the book, sort of requiring recipients of government support to reveal lots of information about themselves, number one, as a condition of receiving support, and then also sometimes relinquishing their freedom to make their own decisions. And sort of this is like forced actions as a condition of support. And that obviously came up in the book as well. This is another question we probably don't have answers to, but we can spitball it anyway. What do you think is an appropriate balance of conditions surrounding receiving support and then also allowing for personal agency in decision-making? And of course, the events in Take My Hand are extreme as an illustration of this.
Well, I'll start with just the forced sterilizations. There were accounts in the archives of women who would go into labor, and while they were in labor, the doctor would say, do you want to get your tubes tied?
Oh.
Even today, when I speak to just friends about, you know, they tied the girl's tubes. I actually had this question early on. Can you get them untied?
Right. Because a vasectomy, you can get it undone. Right?
Right. And there are actually, yes. And I do think there are some kinds of tubal ligations that are not cauterized that you can get undone. I'm not an expert. I'm not a medical expert. But I think the average person isn't quite clear on that, right? So imagine you're in labor, you are trying to get a baby out.
You're in pain, you're exhausted.
Yes, and your doctor all of a sudden is putting this thing in front of you. You have three kids, this is a fourth child. Let me tie your tube so you don't have to go through this anymore. So I think there's real cases, also cases of doctors saying, if you don't get your tubes tied, I'm not going to sign the consent for your Medicaid benefits or whatever other benefits you were getting. So those were typically abuses in the system, right? That's why we have, you know, informed consent laws now. But more generally, this question about government agencies and the balance between receiving support and allowing communities to have some say in how that support is administered and what support is administered. I think that's something that agencies have to take into consideration, you know, on a case-by-case basis. I remember hearing this story a friend told me one time. It could have been my husband's story. He always says I steal his stories and pretend they're mine.
I feel like attorneys end up with a lot of good stories.
They do. It's like, who knows who this story originally came from? Maybe they're listening right now. He said that he saw this homeless guy outside of McDonald's, and someone came out of McDonald's and they handed him a burger. They bought it for him. And the guy goes back in McDonald's and asks to get his money back. And the people behind the register just gave him the money and took the burger back. He said, you know, the lesson there wasn't that some people might have thought like, oh, he's going to go use that money for something bad. But no, the lesson is that he wanted a say in how his good deed or what was the good deed he would receive, right? Like he didn't want a burger. You know, he wanted the money. And so I think that people need to have a say. Just because we have the power to bestow a good deed doesn't mean that we don't have to recognize someone else's wishes. And so that to me is the balance. Like we've got to be in communication. We've got to figure out what the communities need. That's my thought.
And government agencies are not known for their flexibility and ability to individualize per se.
It's hard when you have a lot of bureaucratic red tape, right? You have all this bureaucratic red tape but that's our system. You know, we have to figure out ways to build these bridges. That's the next step. You know, this book is not about building the bridges, but I'm hopeful that people think about like, how do we build real friendships with people in a way that's not exploitative?
Sure. Well, these characters are just unforgettable. And when I was talking about this book on the spring preview, I think I said something like, they just have a place in my heart. Like they were just, you root for them, every single one of them. Well, maybe not the head nurse at the clinic, but other than that, was just rooting for them. And just this book has really stuck with me. And I think it's going to stick with a lot of people.
I hope so. Thank you for saying that.
Of course. And what's next for you? Can you share anything about what you're working on, or have you identified your next story yet?
It's still a mess.
It's a beautiful mess.
It's a beautiful mess. I saw this video or a meme, I guess, on Twitter the other day where someone was on the red carpet and they asked her what she was working on. She wasn't an author, but it was like a perfect author answer. And it was like, well, I can tell you it's a masterpiece. It's a beautiful masterpiece.
Sure.
Which I thought was hilarious. But I think she was being sarcastic. I hope she's being sarcastic. But yeah, that's what I say I'm going to answer to that question, just to hide the fact that I have 150 pages of a mess right now.
Well, I know that I will never be an author. People ask me that all the time. The answer is no. I understand how hard it is, and I know that I probably would not be great at it. But also, I don't understand how authors are writing in this creative space, but also publicizing their book that has just been published. Those are just so just disparate things to be doing at the same time. So kudos to you with a beautiful mess. I don't know how you do it.
A lot of writers, you know, after they do all of the touring and the publicity, they just go back into their writing cave. That's sort of me. But there are some writers out there who do actually do it all at the same time. One of my favorite writers, Chris Bojalian, is just remarkable that he
has to always be writing. He has a book a year out.
He does. He's always writing, and he's always also handling the business side. He's very good at both.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. He does all of his own social media marketing, and he does a lot of touring and events. And then he goes on research trips. I was seeing on social media that he was going on a research trip. He's phenomenal. He's someone I really look up to in terms of career work ethic.
Sure. And we're going to talk about him in a minute a little bit more. So getting into your book recommendations, as usual, Dolan is going to share two old books she loved, two new books she loved, one book she did not love, and one new release that she is excited about. I noticed in your choices, there are a fair amount of historical fiction novels. And I found this interesting because I've heard from a couple other authors who've been on the podcast that they have trouble reading their own genre while they're writing. This doesn't seem to be an issue for you. You seem to like reading historical fiction.
I do. I love to read historical fiction. It doesn't at all shape anything that I'm writing in terms of undue influence. I really enjoy it. And most of my favorite authors are historical fiction writers. In the early days, I did not claim to be an historical fiction writer.
Oh, interesting. What did you claim to be?
I just thought I would write. I didn't know. After I wrote Winch, I said, well, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I might write something contemporary. I just didn't claim it. And then I found that that was what I was reading for fun. I was reading historical novels for fun. I was reading historian books, like books by academic historians, for fun. I love going into the archives. I loved watching history documentaries on TV. It's like all the signs were pointing to it.
You got to roll with it then.
Yes.
All right. Tell me about the first old book you love.
Well, old was pre-summer 2021. So this book isn't that old. I think it came out in 2019, but it's called We Cast a Shadow by Maurice Ruffin. I think Maurice is a major talent. He writes in this sort of, I don't know what to call it, but this voice that is part literary pastiche. It's almost sort of a postmodern voice. It's very smart. It's hilarious. It's sharp. It's caustic racial commentary. He's just a major talent. I can't wait to see what he does. He's a New Orleans writer. He came from New Orleans. And I gave that book, We Cast a Shadow, to all my friends last summer. And they were all walking around all summer with like tattered copies because they were just reading it over the summer, enjoying it. And I would like meet up with them and they'd have it in their bag. Like, I'm still reading this book. It's so good.
And this is not historical fiction. This is like sci-fi kind of near future type.
Yeah, exactly. It has a little dystopic feel to it.
Yes. I have not read this one, but I did a little research into it. And the premise is fascinating and scary and all those things about those near future premises that you feel like, oh, this would be really interesting. But also all of the ramifications of this, where Black people can go to a clinic to be demelanized and pay a lot of money to do that. And then this particular one family, the father really wanting the son to go through this and sort of all of the ramifications of that.
That's right. The father, he's such a fascinating character.
A lot of the Goodreads reviews had mentioned that the narrator is very controversial. And is that the father?
Yes.
Okay. And one other kind of theme I kept seeing over and over is this a satire? Or as Roxane Gay said, no, it's not a satire. It's a cautionary tale.
I think it's both.
Yeah.
You know, he's writing to me. There's a early 20th century writer by the name of George Schuyler, and he wrote a book called Black No More. And to me, Maurice Ruffin is writing directly in the tradition of a George Schuyler, who was a Black contemporary of H.L. Mencken, right? He is a satirist for sure. Whether or not Maurice claims that, I don't know. I've never heard him in an interview. I'm just giving my analysis. If you're out there, Maurice, this is my feeling.
That's what we do here. Give our analysis.
Exactly. Giving my analysis. And whether or not he considers it satire, I don't know. But it feels to me very much like a descendant of Schuyler's book, Black No More.
That was We Cast a Shadow by Maurice Ruffin. And tell me about the second old book you love, which I have read and I also loved.
Yes, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I mean, who didn't read that book, right? I mean, if somebody didn't read that book who's listening, go pick that book up right now, okay? That's like part of your American education.
I know, right? I will say I read it years after it came out.
Uh-huh. I think I read it a couple of years after it came out. It was already a big hit.
Yeah, it was already a big hit. I was in a real life book club back then, and this was the first real life book club pick that I read.
Yes, you know, I had heard of HeLa cells. I don't even know how I had heard of HeLa cells, but I had. And to learn that it was taken from a Black woman and that she died young, tragically died young, and that her family was still impoverished and had never been remunerated in any kind of way. And people had made billions off these cells that are actually some of the most remarkable cells that science has ever seen. It was just stunning to me. I had so many emotions.
A lot of similar themes to Take My Hand.
I was influenced by Rebecca Skloot. I mean, of course, Rebecca Skloot, that's nonfiction. I'm a fiction writer, you know, and she writes, you know, a lot more about medical and science type things. But I was definitely influenced by that book. It was one of those books I could not stop thinking about.
One of the things that struck me about this book is just the story of the family sort of gradually finding out what had happened, and then the more so the impact of what had happened and the extent that these cells had been used and all the medical breakthroughs, the polio vaccine, and her family just, that struck hard.
It really did. And to me, I still think about that family. I still do. To this day, I think, is that family okay? Has anybody taken care of them? Those descendants, you know, I think about them.
Have they been compensated at all? I don't remember. It's been so long. And this may not even have been addressed in the book.
In the book, it wasn't addressed because it was so new, right?
Right. Still ongoing.
You know, that's something that the listeners should look up. I know that there have been various foundations. I know that Johns Hopkins issued a statement about this, but I don't know the answer to that question, but I think about them.
I will do some Googling, and anything I find, I'll link to in the show notes, y'all. All right, that was The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. And tell me about the first new book you loved. This was a big one.
It is. This is my friend, Honoré Fanon Jeffers, who...
She is your friend?
She is my friend.
Oh, wow.
Of decades. We've been friends for decades. And I've always known she was a major talent. I've always thought that about her as a poet. She had a short story I remember reading a long time ago in a Black sci-fi anthology. It was the first story in the anthology, and it blew my socks off. I can't remember the name of it. It'll come back to me. But it was a great short story. So I always knew she could write fiction, but she had really made her career as a poet.
And y'all, just to break in one second, the book is The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois.
Oh, I didn't say the title. Sorry.
That's okay. We launched right into talking about the author.
That's right. We launched right into it. Okay. Yes. The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. She worked on it a long time, but I had no idea this was what she was doing, right? Like, it is a monumental book. It is informed by so much of Honoré's different talents. It's informed by her poetic sensibility. It's informed by her Southern roots. It's informed by her knowledge of history, right? Like, she has a poetry collection. Most famous poetry collection probably is the one about Phyllis Wheatley, the earliest Black American poet. Honoré has a real sense of Du Bois, and The Souls of Black Folks is clearly an influence. The lyrical interludes in that book are here. It's an epic novel. You know, it's also informed by Honoré's living in Oklahoma and feeling connected to Native American community and the connections between Black and Native communities. That book is just so rich. I'm still processing it, honestly. I feel like I should read it again.
I have not read this yet because I have a certain category of books that is very long books that require a lot of concentration. And those are my retirement books that I put on the table for when my kids are a little bit older and life isn't as crazy. This is one of my retirement books. A number of my reader friends whose taste I generally align with absolutely loved this. I've heard just everyone that I've heard from that has read this book has used words like stunning and instant classic, just big words that, I mean, kind of astounding that this is a debut, that kind of stuff about this one.
It is stunning that it's a debut. It really is. But like I said, she's a writer with a long career, and she's not new to writing at all, but it is, and it's a commitment. Honestly, when I received it, I had no idea it was going to be 800 pages. I was like, yeah, I'll read it. And then I got it and I was like, what? You know. And when I got it, I got like an ebook form. So I was actually, I didn't know how long it was. I just started reading.
Right. You're like, this percentage is ticking up very slowly.
Yes, exactly. And then I looked and I said, oh my gosh, let me get myself together. You know, you have to get yourself together for a book like this for sure.
Sure.
I say this is a summer read. If somebody wants a nice long summer novel to tide them over, this is a great winter break read. Like if you have time off from work.
That week between Christmas and New Year's.
That's right.
All right. That was The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Fanon Jeffers. And what is the second new book you loved?
So the second new book is Hour of the Witch by Chris Bohjalian. And I really enjoyed that book. Every now and then, I just love a good old-fashioned 17th century novel. You know, I'm a person who, I write historical fiction, so I know how hard it is to write in the 17th century. It is so hard because of the way they talked, because of the references, because of all of the research you have to do. You know, this book is set in New England in the late 1600s. And it is a very religious community, and they believe that forks are the, you know, sign of the devil because it looks like a pitchfork. And one of the women finds a fork buried in her yard, and people in the town begin to think she's a witch, and she doesn't know who buried that fork. She has an abusive husband and she wants to divorce him, and she tries to divorce him, and the town denies the divorce and he beats her. So it is a book about, one thing I always say about Chris Bohjalian, he writes like a woman. I don't know if that's going to offend anybody, but he knows I've said that about him, but he writes the best women characters that I've seen any man write. You know, like he just understands women and he writes women so convincingly. He's got such dexterity on the page. I mean, he can write any character, really. He's just really good. And I enjoyed this one. I thought he does his research, clearly. I felt like it was in that time. There's a real balance with language because you've got a lot of these and thous and thys in the 7th century. But the contemporary reader can only take so much of that. So he strikes that balance between contemporary language and older language in a way that feels real, but also is readable. But I'm telling you, you write this book, you open this book, and from page two, you can't put it down. It's also just spellbinding. I'll just say that too.
The premise sounds really interesting. And I know a lot of it is a court trial, which I always love in my books. And I did hear in the Goodreads reviews about the writing style, that it is sort of, a lot of it is written in the style of the time.
Yes. You have to. I mean, it's the 1600s. Otherwise, it just feels like contemporary.
I feel a little bit like Chris is going back to his roots with this book. Like there were a couple thrillers in a row. And then, I mean, I read him years ago when he wrote more historical fiction. And then I feel like he's kind of gone through this thriller thing. And like now he's sort of circling back, which is interesting.
It is. And I kind of feel like that is the joy, and that's the privilege of success. When you get to the level Chris Bohjalian is at, you can say, hey, you know, I think I want to write a thriller. I think I want to write a mystery. Like he can just explore creatively and do different things, and his publisher does it and his readers love it. I feel like I'm still building within my niche, and I'm still like, really, like my readers, when they pick up a book by me, I want them to sort of know what they're getting right now. But if I had, I don't know how many books he has now, 16, 17, if I had 16 or 17 books, or even, you know, 13, 14, I might say, you know, I have always wanted to write a rom-com. And that is a little secret. I would like to write a rom-com one day. I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't read a lot of rom-coms, but every now and then I do. And I love the escape.
Right. Could you do sort of a rom-com feel and story set in historical times?
That's really interesting.
I like it when people switch things up. So the idea of doing something different like that is appealing.
I agree.
All right. That was Hour of the Witch by Chris Bajalian. We are all going to await your historical rom-com. And tell me about the book you did not love.
You know, I'm not a big Ernest Hemingway fan. I have, you know, really gone to these writers because I'm in the academic world. I've really gone to these writers afresh, like with an open mind and outside of the context of teaching. And I've just determined like which ones I enjoy and which ones I don't. And Hemingway is one that I could pass on. I don't find it interesting. I don't particularly love the style. It's just not my thing.
And this particular one, A Farewell to Arms.
Yes.
My listeners know this about me. I am notorious for having trouble with the classics. I read whatever I read in school back in the day. I don't remember much of it. Mm-hmm. I have no interest to pick them up again, but I do remember not liking The Sun Also Rises. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't get this. I don't understand why this is monumental in any way. But what I really do enjoy is when a guest brings a classic as the book they didn't love, and a lot of authors do this, which is totally fine. I like looking at the Goodreads reviews for that classic. And one of them was titled, War is Boring. And that's kind of what I feel like a little bit.
Unless it's like a woman on the front line who's a spy.
Right, exactly.
Like, I feel like I don't need more sort of like masculine, gun-wielding, you know, I don't need more of that.
X's and O's of battles. Well, Woman on the Front Lines, you just transitioned very nicely into the new release you would like to talk about.
Yes. Now, I pre-ordered my copy. Hopefully, it's home waiting for me when I get back. But I think Kate Quinn is one of the best in the game in terms of historical writers. She's smart. She is got her finger on the pulse. I mean, who would have known that Russia was going to invade Ukraine and make this book about, you know, Hitler invading Ukraine and Russia so relevant for us to learn this history, right?
That is exactly the thing that jumped out at me when I dug into this a little bit. And the book is The Diamond Eye.
I keep forgetting to say the titles, don't I?
That's okay. That's my job.
Yes, The Diamond Eye by Kate Quinn. Now, I first read Kate Quinn, her book, The Alice Network, which I absolutely loved and which taught me a lot about writing a dual timeline novel. And then I went to the Historical Novel Society conference and I met her in person, and just lovely, lovely person. It always helps when the person is lovely. And I just admired her. I went to her panels to hear what she had to say, because I had read The Alice Network, and I just thought, how do you put together this book set, you know, between the 1940s and then like 1915 with these two narratives, and then eventually of these women, extraordinary women, and then you bring them together at the end of the book so that everything fits. Like, I just thought the structure of that book was so wonderful. And then also, she just writes really good characters.
This character sounds very interesting.
In The Diamond Eye?
Yes. Female librarian who becomes a top sniper in World War II.
Yes. See, if you're going to have a war book, do that.
This is interesting war.
Yes, exactly.
The book is set in Kyiv, which at the time of the book was Russia, but obviously now is Ukraine.
But here's the good part. The good part is that we all get to learn something. About a lot of people don't know a lot about the history of Ukraine and Russia. I mean, I don't.
I don't either. What I know is from watching the Olympics and watching the shifting of the teams as the years have gone by.
Well, and here's the thing. We need to understand why the Ukrainian people are fighting so vigorously.
Sure.
Right? There's a history behind that refusal to surrender. And I think that books like Kate's really, for me, I can read a historian's work, but I prefer to read the work of a novelist like Kate Quinn, because one, I know she's done her homework.
Yeah.
Two, I know she's going to spin a good story. I know it's just going to be entertaining, right? And three, I know when I put that book down, I come away from it smarter, better, more enlightened. Like, I just feel like it's, she's good. Fiona Davis, who is another friend of mine in the historical fiction world, said she's the reigning queen of historical fiction. And that's true. I'm going to give it to Kate. I'm going to say, like, she's at the top of the game right now.
Yeah. Sales figures, too. All right. That was The Diamond Eye by Kate Quinn. And that came out March 29th. I love to close out my episodes by asking my guest one final question. What is the last 5-star book you read?
The last 5-star book I read has not come out yet.
Oh, good.
Yes. And it comes out in May. It's called Miss Chloe. It's by a writer named AJ Verdell. She is a writer she's a contemporary of Alice Walker and Gloria Naylor. But she's like an elder statesman now in the literary world. She's a dear friend of mine and hasn't published a book in years. And this is a memoir about her friendship with Toni Morrison.
Oh, wow.
Whose birth name, as you know, was Chloe Wolford, I think. And she writes very intimately about their friendship and about Miss Chloe, as she called her, Miss Chloe's effect on her. It was a window into Morrison that I'd never seen, that I feel like it's going to really humanize her a lot more, because right now she just is iconic and we see her as this sort of goddess. Even at the end when she's in that wheelchair, it was like the goddess is in the room. Okay. I just loved it. And then she also parallels that friendship alongside her own sort of literary birthing and how she came to love books. So you understand a lot about, like, her love for books and her love for literature. It's a wonderful book, and I'm going to recommend it to everybody when it comes out.
And that's coming out May 10th, y'all, so very soon. Thank you so much, Dolan. This was such a great conversation, and I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
The May Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Dolan's picks for categories like one surprising thing you learned in your research that did not fit in the book, and best novel about a landmark historical event other than her own. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show on Patreon. There's a link in my show notes and in my Instagram bio. In 2 weeks, which is May 18th, Susie from Novel Visits will be joining me for our annual summer reading special. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.